DW Deutsche Welle. Spectrum.
Hello and welcome to Spectrum on DW, deep and dirty as ever in the world of science and technology. I'm Zulfikar Abani, and coming up, we've got goal line technology, spying on space with the European Space Agency's drones app, and we dip into the worlds of digital and analog music making in the 21st century.
Let me introduce to you the most legendary analog synth of all time, in my humble opinion, the Mini Moog synthesizer. Let's make some noise. See how that sounds.
That, and we speak to legendary digital synth innovator and app maker Wolfgang Palm, right here on Spectrum. But first, this month, the body that governs international football, FIFA, is due to make what some are calling a very important decision on goal line technology. FIFA will choose one of four approved goal line technologies to be the one that's used at the next Confederations Cup and at next year's World Cup in Brazil. Now, our very own Chipona Chimbelu has visited a factory where one of the FIFA approved systems is made. He reports now on the technology that could be about to change the game.
He looked it. Referee looked at the assistant, and the assistant kept his flag down.
Soccer rivals Germany and England are playing in the round of 16 at the 2010 World Cup. Frank Lampard has just scored, but the ref didn't see the goal, so it doesn't count. No surprise that England supporters feel cheated after their team's 4-1 loss. Shortly after the 2010 Germany-England match, FIFA announced that it would reopen the discussion on systems to help determine when a goal has been scored. And in February this year, FIFA announced goal line technologies would be used at the 2014 World Cup, making it the first world championships to use technology in determining goals. Former Bundesliga footballer Torben Hoffmann, who now works as a sports reporter for Sky, welcomes the change.
There are always situations in which, even after the game, fans discuss whether a goal was actually a goal or not a goal. And if we could see that, then the game would have gone differently. And at the end of the day, there's a lot hanging on football. There's so much invested.
One of the systems, Goal Control, is made by a company of the same name on the outskirts of Aachen, near the border between Germany and the Netherlands. Goal Control's managing director, Dirk Bruchhausen, explains how its goal line technology works.
The system works with 14 cameras divided into 7 cams per each goal. The cams are mounted on the catwalk close to the roof of the stadium, and it's independently working with all balls, all nets, and no modifications anywhere. So then the system is able to send out a signal when the ball crosses a line. The signal will route to a referee's watch, and the referee then, within 1 second, able to decide was it a goal or was it not.
The 14 cameras are hooked to 15 computers, which run a special program, as Bruchhausen says.
The special software program running is able to work with 500 pictures per second per each cam, and this special software program is then very able also to detect the ball in every situation close to the goal, within the net or outside. And this special possibility enables also to have a very big flexibility regarding the color of the net and types of balls.
Every second, the cameras produce 2 gigabytes of data, which is transmitted to the 15 computers via fiber optic cables for processing. Data streams like this sound mind-boggling, but camera technology itself isn't that new. UK-based Hawkeye Innovations has a system of the same name that is used in cricket and tennis. Hawkeye uses images from cameras positioned at different angles to recreate and display the ball's trajectory. The Hawkeye system has also been licensed by FIFA for use in football. But FIFA's plans to use such systems have brought about a new technology. smart balls. Germany's Fraunhofer Society has developed goal-line technology that uses a smart ball and works like security tags in stores that beep when someone tries to walk out without paying for something, as a spokesperson René Dunkler explains.
We have an intelligent goal who built up a magnetic field, and then we have special ball, and if this ball cross over the goal line, then the intelligent goals knows this and can detect the goal, and this information will wireless transmitted to the wristwatch of the referee.
The system developed by Fraunhofer is called GoRef and uses a transmitter in the ball that communicates with an antenna on the goalpost to alert the ref when the ball has crossed the goal line.
Has he made it? No, Nadal's challenging. Usually he's challenging.
Ball tracking systems have radically transformed tennis. Since 2005, players have been able to raise an arm during the game and challenge a call by an umpire. But former footballer Torben Hoffmann doesn't believe this would work in football.
You have to draw the line somewhere. For me, this would be the only aid that would be used in football.
But even when they get an alert within a second of a goal being scored, refs will still be able to bungle plenty of calls on the pitch. Still, goal line technology has the potential to transform professional football. The English Premier League is implementing goal line technology this year, so fans around the world will get to see how this works in practice. But whether technology makes for fairer sports is a whole other question. Chipona Chimbelu for DW in Wusselen near Aachen.
Digital Europe, bringing the continent's tech scene to your ears.
So, we all want one, but who really knows what they're good for? Unless you're in the army, that is. I'm talking, of course, about private drones like the quadcopter Parrot AR drone. Even the thrill of taking a snoop around your neighbourhood and filming what you see will wear off pretty quickly, I imagine, and we wouldn't suggest doing that anyway. It's probably illegal in some places, or about to be. But what if you could help space scientists gather data to improve future Mars missions? Well, you can now with the European Space Agency's AstroDrone app. I spoke to ESA researcher Guido de Groen to find out more.
The drone has so many sensors on board already. It has two cameras, one to the front, one to the bottom. It has sonar, it has accelerometers. So what it can do is it can, in principle, fly itself. If you press takeoff, it will just take off and it would just hover. And it's actually meant for playing augmented reality games. So you look at your iPhone, you see through the camera of the drone, so it's as if you're sitting in a drone, let's say, but you can also project things in there that do not exist in reality. And in our case, we project a virtual world in which you see the International Space Station.
And through this game, you want to collect data?
Yeah, the goal of the game is, the game itself is to dock to the International Space Station, as astronauts have to do as well. But the goal of the project is scientific. So if people play the game, we hope they have fun. We hope that they get in touch a bit with space and space exploration. But we also hope that they help our experiment, which they can do by going to the high score table and saying yes to participating. In that case, data is extracted from the images that the drone made on board so that we can improve the way that robots see distances.
Right, so what exact data are we talking about?
First off, we're not interested in the raw images, so we don't send raw images. We also don't send compressed images or something like that, because our goal is not reconstruction. What we do send is visually salient points that are extracted from the image, and these cannot be looked at by humans. We can do very little with it, but robots can use it to see distances, so they can also use it to recognize objects.
And that would be your aim in the future, wouldn't it? To be able to teach robots to basically work better on space missions, for
exactly.
instance.
So in many space missions, the robot would be so far from a human operator that they have to operate autonomously. And this app, what we try to do is that the robot learns stuff about its environment. So if you take a human, for example, we see distances in many ways. One is stereo vision. You have two eyes, and with your two eyes, you can determine distances to objects. But another one is that we also recognize objects. So we recognize that something is a face, and if a face has a certain size on our retina, so let's say our image, then we know immediately how far this face is away. And we learn that by experience. And that's the idea behind this app, that we have a lot of robots that are flying around in the world in very different environments, and that they start learning the sizes of objects by themselves. So that when we send robots later on to a planet or a moon, that in the beginning they use perhaps only things like stereo vision, for which you do not have to know the environment you're in. But on the longer term, they start recognizing things already at a distance.
I am interested to know, though, your take on the debate around drones, certainly privately owned drones, and how they're used in private residential areas. You're not worried, are you, concerned that you may be encouraging people to sort of snoop on their neighbours while playing this game, in a way?
So this game, entirely not, because, as I said, we really create a virtual reality. So what you see on your iPhone or iPad is the virtual world. So you see space, you see the International Space Station.
But you're encouraging the use of these drones, though, in a private manner, aren't you? I mean, this is machinery that's being used on the one hand by official military organizations, but also by private people. And there's been a lot of concerns over privacy issues.
Yeah, I think, okay, first, I think the focus in this debate is a lot on military applications, police, perhaps. But there is a really big range of civil applications that will be very useful. Now, you will have to regulate, in some sense, what's happening. I see the drone in our project mainly as a toy with which people can do fantastic things. As all technology, it can be used for bad things and good things. And I trust that many people will use it in the right way.
Guido de Groen of the European Space Agency on the line there from the Netherlands. And you're listening to Spectrum with me, Zulfi Karabani, on DW. Online, we're at dw.de/spectrum. And you can, of course, follow us as ever at dw_SciTech. In the past few years, music technology has seen amazing parallel developments in both analog and digital machinery. While the sounds of the vintage analog synthesizers have been standards in electronic music since, well, the rave scene of the 1980s, what we're seeing now is a growing movement of musicians and engineers towards building their own DIY synths. You may not see so many electronics shops selling circuit boards and other components on the high streets anymore, but you can get all that gear over the net from like-minded enthusiasts. At the same time, over in the digital world, the prospect of using mobile devices like the iPad to run fairly professional music-making apps in the studio and live is starting to become a reality. And we'll be talking about mobile apps with an inventor who's worked in both the analog and digital fields in just a moment. That's Wolfgang Palm. But first, here's Pavel Schrey, who's just built his own DIY synth.
A synthesizer is an electronic musical instrument. First developed in the late 19th century, it became very common in popular music from the 1960s onwards. Synthesizers come in many forms, and they can make sounds like this. Sounds like this. Or even quite intense sounds like this. Synthesizers were once hugely expensive. Today, we're lucky that many synths have become very affordable. I just bought a small synth from eBay for about 30 euros. It's called a Synthrotech NAND 4093, and it's a little smaller than an iPhone. But it's a do-it-yourself kit, and I'm going to try and put it together. But first, I want to understand how a synthesizer actually works. To find out, I spoke to Anthony Norris, an award-winning sound engineer, producer and senior lecturer at the Royal Melbourne Institute of Technology in Australia.
So a synth is a controlled voltage device. We power a tone generator, and that tone generator will produce, for argument's sake, a sine wave. We can then send that circuit into another one, thereby modulating one tone with another, and then we would shape that sound with a few other components, such as an envelope or a filter. All of that then needs to go through a voltage-controlled amplifier.
So a synthesizer needs an electrical current to produce a waveform or a sound, which is then shaped and manipulated. There are many types of synth and electronic instruments, and one of the first was the theremin, which the Beach Boys used on their classic Good Vibrations. I'm picking up good vibrations,
she's giving me the excitations. The Beach Boys were one of the first ones to use the theremin in a commercial track. From then we just saw a whole swathe of artists starting to use synths as a means of creating sounds that weren't essentially trying to emulate acoustic instruments. They were their own beast altogether.
The cost of electronic instruments when they were first manufactured was out of reach for all but the most wealthy. In the 1980s, Anthony Norris worked for Fairlight, an Australian company which made the legendary Fairlight CMI, a digital sampling synthesizer.
The price of the 2X machine was approximately $200,000 at the time. Herbie Hancock bought one. Stevie Wonder, I think, might have bought one. Of course, Duran Duran had one. And the consequence of that was the shaping of the 1980s pop sound.
But the man who brought synthesizers to the masses was American inventor Robert Moog. He pioneered the Moog synthesizer, which became one of the most famous electronic instruments of all time. I wanted to hear a Moog in action, so I went to the Berlin studio of Thomas Schumacher, legendary German producer and DJ. I'm here with Thomas Schumacher in Berlin. Thomas, can you make some noise for us? Some synth noise, please.
Let me give it a try. Pretty sure I can, actually. Let me introduce to you the most legendary analog synth of all time, in my humble opinion, the Mini Moog synthesizer. Let's make some noise. See how that sounds.
So I had to wait a few weeks, but the synth DIY kit, the Synthrotech, just arrived in the post today. And I've got all the pieces I need here in this package. We've got a bunch of different components here. We've got some capacitors, resistors, some linear pots, switches, jacks, some wires, and of course the circuit board. So I've got a soldering iron here, and I'll be using this to attach the components of the synth to the circuit board. Okay, so I've soldered the 14-pin socket into the board with 5 capacitors, and now I'm going to attach the 3 switches onto the board. Now I need to attach the wires to the side of the board, which will then be attached to the switches, which will control volume, rate, etc. Okay, so after a few hours' work, the soldering is now finished. The small green circuit board looks like it sprouted red wires. These wires hook up to the 3 silver switches and the 4 control knobs. The board is also covered with small yellow capacitors, resistors, and a black socket. So now I'm just going to connect it to some power and, with a bit of luck, start to make some noise. So now I have a working synth, what can I actually do with it? And how can I start to make music with it? Manuel Richter is a prominent ambient musician and sound engineer from Leipzig who runs Leaf Audio. He also builds his own synthesizers.
I'm building own stuff, yeah, effect boxes, distortions, little synthesizers. You can reach a very high quality when you do DIY stuff. It depends on your skills and on the complexity, what you build.
Interestingly, Manuel uses a combination of these low-tech DIY synths combining them with high-tech gear.
What I like is to integrate raw, low-tech stuff into this high-quality studio equipment. And then you can process low-tech sound, for example, with high-tech filters or compressors or whatever. And this is really interesting.
And Manuel says that what he really loves about synthesizers is their versatility.
Yeah, you can create bass sounds, you can create lead sounds, you can create drum sounds, you can create snares, bass drums, hi-hats, whatever you want.
So I've now put together the DIY synth, and I've had a chance to record some of its sounds and mix it into a song. Come to one of my shows and you might even hear me play it live. This is Pavel Schrey reporting for DW.
Well, actually, just hang around to the end of the show and you'll get to hear some of that music that Pavel's made with his DIY synth. So no need to go and see him live just yet in Australia, although he does tell me he's been rather busy on the festival circuit this summer in the Southern Hemisphere. Right, well, analog synths are one thing, but what about the 21st century, I hear you scream? Well, Pavel mentioned the Fairlight company there. One of their best-known synths had a big white keyboard with a computer monitor and stylus hanging off of it, so you could influence stuff that way. It was one of the first music samplers, as was the Synclavier, and a similar machine made by a man called Wolfgang Palm here in Germany was also around back in the day. He invented what's known as wavetable synthesis, one of the many types of digital audio synthesis and one that helped shape the sounds of the 80s with a range of PPG Wave 2 synths. Now, if you'll excuse the time warp, jumping up three decades, Wolfgang Palm has now started to produce critically acclaimed iPad apps, one of which is called the Wave Generator, the other Wave Mapper. The Wave Generator is a virtual recreation of the original wavetable synthesis hardware, but it's a fraction of the size and a fraction of the price. And as Wolfgang Palm told me on the line from Hamburg, the possibilities brought on by touchscreen technology are simply grand.
I also started with analog synthesizers in the mid-70s, it was. So my first stuff was like Moog and everything with low-pass filters and the typical stuff. But then there was always the problem with pitch instability, which means if the temperature in the room was rising, then the octaves and the scale was not correct anymore. So that was always a problem, and that brought me to the idea to develop digital oscillators. So my first digital synthesizer was still had an analog filter and analog VCA amplifier and stuff, but only digital oscillators, which I called digital controlled oscillators, DCO. Yeah, it took some time for me to find out that if you have a digital oscillator, it's not a big step anymore to change the waveform. I mean, not to have just the sawtooth and the pulse wave, but to have some individual waves, because each cycle of a waveform, for example, has 128 steps. So if you change these steps, you get different waveforms and different sounds. And so that's slowly the idea evolved to have this wavetable principle, which I was the first to use.
So tell us about the wavetable principle, because this is something that we probably, without knowing, a lot of people have heard on countless records, whether it's Depeche Mode, one of my all-time favorite bands, or Stevie Wonder even, I believe, has used the wavetable synthesis. What exactly is happening there? I mean, that's really how you create the sound, isn't it?
Yes, I mean, how the machine creates the sound, yes. As I said, one cycle has some different steps, and now the thing is, you can compare it with a movie. You have this frames, let's say 24 frames per second, which means you have 24 pictures which run through in 1 second. And in the wavetable, it's the same principle. You have, let's say, 100 different waveforms. And if you change the waveform from one to another in, let's say, one second, you play these 100 waveforms, then you have a wave sweep, you can say, which you can compare with a movie. If you run the movie, you run all the pictures very fast, and you don't see the pictures anymore, you just get the evolving sound, the evolving film, the film.
Yeah.
And in the sound, it's the same. You get a sound sweep.
And so moving forward now, let's be brash about it, a couple of decades, you're now producing iPad apps.
Yeah.
There's the Wave Generator, for one, which I've used.
Yeah.
Is that a natural progression for you from the original synths that you made?
What can I say? I mean, I did a lot of research and development in the three decades now. since the 70s. And I did a lot of stuff with speech analysis, speech synthesis, and all kinds of models which you use for a synthesizer. So you cannot say it was a natural progression, but the wave generator app, yeah, you can say that's a kind of reproduction of the old work from the 70s.
I mean, I suppose, put another way, if the technology of this tablet technology, and the touchscreen technology was available back in the 70s or the 80s, would these have been the synths that you would have made back then? That's, I suppose, what I'm asking.
Yeah, I mean, the touch thing is just a nice way to control the parameters, you know. But you can also control the parameters with a computer mouse or with a knob, or I don't know. But it's the iPad has very nice features. Of course, you can control, let's say with three fingers, you can control three times X, Y parameters. It's like having three mice, you know. So that's a great thing.
And also, you can take photos with through the app and use that as the basis for your waveform. So really, it's totally unique.
Yeah.
I mean, have the developments in software and design changed the way you want to make music, though, or create sound? I mean, you know, these apps, they're tiny, really, aren't they? Just a What about 30 MB compared to what used to be a massive piece of physical hardware? You know, has that changed the way you want to make music and create sound?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. I mean, that's hard to say. I mean, you can today produce a sound using, I don't know, 200 sine waves, which have each sine wave would have an individual envelope, but nobody can control that. I mean, do you like to control 200 envelopes and just to produce a sound? And so the old synthesis is one easy way to create some sounds just by a low pass filter and by a sawtooth wave or something. So that's only one way, but there are so many different synthesis models, like physical modeling, and I don't know. So this wouldn't depend on the iPad or on the hardware.
We've spoken about the iPad, but of course there are many different mobile platforms, and more and more musicians, DJs, producers are using these mobile platforms in the production of music. They're taking them on the road. They're using them to modulate their music in a live scenario. But do you think they have the ability really to perhaps maybe not replace real instruments in that sense, but are we getting to the point where it is really more than just a toy? We are talking about real instruments here.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, of course, there will always be the classical hardware instruments like flute or trumpet and so on. And there will always be keyboards with a standard piano keyboard. But I think the iPad with these touch features, gives quite new possibilities, which you don't have on a keyboard. And that's very interesting. And so I think people will play not all music on the iPad, but some solos or things which you can't play on a keyboard. That's very nice on the touch screen. So, I think it will not replace the hardware keyboard, but it's a nice addition for musicians.
Wolfgang Palm, thank you very much.
Okay, thanks.
And that was the very friendly Wolfgang Palm speaking to me there from Hamburg. And since the interview, we've tossed a few emails back and forth. And in one of them, he asked me to mention that the reason his apps are so small is that he doesn't use samples. That's recordings of sounds, as other developers do. And his wavetables mean you can reduce the size of the app by about 10 to 1, which is pretty impressive. Also, if you want to read up on digital and analog synthesis, do head to our page where you'll find a transcript of the interview with Wolfgang Palm and some useful links to glossaries and that sort of a thing. It's really fascinating stuff. Well, that's just about all from Spectrum on DW for now. Don't forget, you can always keep up with our stuff at dw.de/science. Listen again or download the podcast at dw.de/spectrum. I'm Zulfikar Abani. Our studio tech was Thomas Schmidt. Join us next time if you can. Until then, thanks for listening, and here's Pavel.